Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, with the best stories of the week from the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from Sin in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Walkley Foundation. And today on the show...
The capital C stamp on the Shadow Cabinet. No one really is surprised by that. We expected him to do that. He's sort of a crash-through-or-crash type of politician, and that's the sort of opposition it will be.
After becoming opposition leader, Angus Taylor has overhauled his shadow cabinet.
It provides great reassurance, I think, for those particular survivors, but also into the future now. And because it's legislation rather than a court case, it establishes this as the law.
Victoria takes a major step forward in supporting survivors of sexual assault with a new law closing a key legal loophole. And later today...
Then been discounted again, and the court has to decide whether the discount is genuine, even though the price rise was only for a short period of time.
Coles is in court over allegations of misleading discounts. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Angus Taylor has reshuffled his shadow cabinet after becoming opposition leader, promoting key allies as he prepares to challenge the government. The shakeup brings back conservative figures like Jacinta Napijimpa-Price and reinstates National Party ministers who were previously suspended for breaking cabinet solidarity. To break down the winners and losers, 2SER's Stephen Hill spoke with Associate Professor Paul Williams from Griffith University and Phil Khoury from the Australian Financial Review.
Look, I think it's a pretty clear message. I don't think anyone's left in the dark about he's not going to be an equivocal opposition leader. We all know he's from the National Right. We all know he's a capital C conservative, and he's put the capital C stamp on the shadow cabinet. No one really is surprised by that. We expected him to do that. He's sort of a crash through or crash type of politician, and that's the sort of opposition it will be.
According to the political editor of the Australian Financial Review, Phil Khoury, the Liberal Party was already lurching to the right policy-wise before the Angus Taylor announcements.
Yes, not a huge change of direction. If you look at where Susan Lee was trying to go, especially on the economy and immigration, she was headed in a similar direction. But I think it's the case of emphasis here that Taylor's making no bones about wanting to be hardline on immigration and return to a more liberal way of economic management that's helped them for so long. Now, Susan Lee made all those same points. She was about to release a fairly hardline immigration policy and had made a lot of statements about getting back to focusing on debt and deficit and trying to fix the economy. But it wasn't really cutting through for a number of reasons. One of them was, you know, she wasn't getting a lot of clean air from her own side, to be honest. But what Taylor has here is certainly the advantage of being the new guy. People are prepared to sit up and listen. You get a brief window after you become a new leader. People are interested in what you have to say. And in this instance, he's sort of probably articulating things a bit better and a bit more forcefully than Lee was able to. And that's really the key difference.
A big part of the Taylor reshuffle is built around the economic portfolios, and we've seen the elevation of Tim Wilson to Shadow Treasurer and Jane Hume. Wilson in particular is known for his effectiveness in framing Bill Shorten's mooted change to franked dividends as a retirement tax. Do you think that the new messengers might be able to more effectively take up the economic fight to the government?
Well, that's the intention. Back to Tim Wilson. Look, I thought Ted O'Brien was pretty good, but Wilson was sort of this fearless warrior. A bit like the Terminator, you just blow him up or drive the truck over him and he gets up and he's coming at you again with those little red eyes. You know, you can't stop the guy. And so he has this relentlessness about him, which I think has earned him the job. And as you rightfully pointed out, as a backbencher back in 2019 when Labor went to that election, that the polls, everyone else suggested they should have won. One of the real reasons they came undone was because they just went a step too far with promising to revoke these cash refunds for excess franking credits, and it really scared all the retirees. Now, it was Wilson who prosecuted that case as a backbencher, set up a committee and an inquiry, and it really became for Labor a bit like Work Choices was for the Liberals back in 2007, and something they'll never touch again. He's got this reputation for being able to, you know, prosecute a case and be fairly hardline about it. And it'll be a really interesting matchup between him and Jim Chalmers. Chalmers is fairly aggressive himself, different sort of person. So, you know, I think it's the matchup everyone's going to be looking forward to when Parliament resumes.
Among the biggest losers in the reshuffle is Immigration Minister Senator Paul Scar. Mm. Now, Scar was a Lees supporter, but is his demotion a sign that Angus Taylor wants to adopt a more muscular approach when it comes to immigration?
Look, pretty much. At the end of the day, I think Ronald Reagan said you've got to dance with the one that brung you, and that means we always see this when a new leader comes in. They've got to reward the people who voted for them and help them get the leadership, and that always means the people who supported the other candidate, you know, the loser, have to make way, and Scar was one of those. He's a very thoughtful person, Paul. He's very smart. I thought his stuff in immigration was good. He wasn't a softie by any means. He had helped author this fairly hard-line policy that was going to be released, or elements of it at least. But what you've seen is this fellow called John O'Dunham, who is the Home Affairs spokesman. That is the senior portfolio. Immigration is in the junior ministry. And what's happened is Dunham now has immigration incorporated into Home Affairs. So he's cabinet-level right-winger who's going to oversee the whole thing. So, yes, it does give full control of immigration to the right.
That was 2SER Stephen Hill with the story. This week marks a significant step forward towards justice for survivors of sexual assault in Victoria. Parliament has passed the Justice Legislation Amendment Bill, a law that fixes a loophole that once stopped some survivors from holding institutions accountable or claiming compensation. I spoke with Kathleen Moulton, CEO of Sexual Assault Services Victoria, about what this law means for survivors.
This is a great relief for many, many survivors who essentially were eligible to compensation because of child sexual abuse by priests and other people. And many people, thousands of people, had pending cases essentially when the High Court decided that priests or a particular priest shouldn't be considered as employee-like, which reversed what it had been the practice until then. So there were, thousands of people in limbo. And this judgment re-establishes what we all know, that those priests were not working for themselves. They were working for the church, and the church had responsibilities and often, you know, knew what was happening or should have known. It provides great reassurance, I think, for those particular survivors, but also into the future now. And because it's legislation rather than a court case, it establishes this as the law of the land in Victoria.
How did the Bird versus DP High Court decision leave survivors in that legal limbo, as you mentioned?
The court determined that the practice that had been established, which was to accept that the churches and similar organisations had vicarious liability for priests, etc., it said, well, no, that was not explicit or that should not be read into the law. The law didn't provide that. And so it essentially sent the issue back to Parliament to fix. Problem is, of course, that Parliaments often work slowly and people don't know what the outcome might be. And so courts just had to proceed with that determination from the High Court, not dictating, but sort of setting the parameters of the decisions they could make. So it meant that many survivors who should have been able to expect restitution and recognition of what happened to them weren't able to. And the courts can't also say, well, we're just going to wait while Parliament works this out. That's not how it works. So cases went through where people who had a very good prospect of reasonable restitution got very little or nothing. So, yeah, that was the flow-on impact from the High Court decision.
Why is Sexual Assault Services Victoria advocating for two minor amendments in the bill?
They're minor but important. So one of the changes is at the moment the legislation says essentially that someone, an institution can have vicarious liability for somebody, for example, when they're doing as a volunteer activities that are sort of integral to their role. Well, sexual assault is integral to nobody's role. So we want the wording to be changed so it says when they're doing their ordinary role, their day-to-day activities, that make it clear that they're a volunteer. The second issue that we're concerned about is that there's something in the law that talks about needing to establish the extent of control of a institution over an employee, and we're concerned that that will open a way for people to say, oh, well, I didn't really know, or I shouldn't have had to know. And given they know that there is a deep, long, damaging history of institutions going, well, we couldn't have known full well that their employees or volunteers were raping children, we're concerned about that being left in.
What does this, I guess, bill mean for the rest of the states?
Look, as I understand it, the attorneys general around the country have really been looking at this issue and trying to get a shared position. So the ACT has already moved. Now Victoria is, I hope that this, in a sense, both gives encouragement to other states and territories to act and puts some pressure on them.
That was Kathleen Maltzen, CEO of Sexual Assault Services Victoria, speaking to The Wire. It's been 18 years since Australia's national apology to the Stolen Generation. But for many survivors, justice remains unfinished. As survivors grow older, the medical and psychological care needs are becoming more urgent. Yet some are still waiting for official redress. Redress schemes differ widely across the country, and Queensland remains the only state without one. For Triple Z's Mary Kate Hannigan spoke with Narelle Bedford, Yoon woman and Bond University law professor, for more.
Particularly concerned because Queensland does not have a scheme for its stolen generation survivors.
With Queensland now being the only state without a redress scheme, what impact is that having on survivors still waiting for justice?
Well, I think it's really fundamentally unfair because it now depends on which part of Australia you were removed from as to whether you receive any individual recognition and compensation. And a lot of the stolen generation survivors, as they age, have quite acute health and emotional needs. And so something like having a best practice redress scheme would make all the difference in the world to their lives.
Do we know why the compensation outcomes vary so widely depending on which state a survivor was taken from?
I think it just comes down to the choices made by governments in each of the state and territories. And so what I'm saying for Queensland, it's an invitation to say, well, if a scheme were to be put in place, we can draw on the experiences of the other states and territories, and we can put in place a best practice redress scheme.
That best practice, your research found that schemes in Victoria and Tasmania are working better than others. What are they getting right?
Tasmania in particular had the ability for children of stolen generation survivors to apply if those survivors have passed away. And that's really important because that recognises the intergenerational trauma and the disadvantages that can flow from one generation to the next. The Tasmanian scheme is closed to new applications, and one of my recommendations is that arbitrary closing dates would be removed. The reason why the Victorian scheme received positive comment from me was because it is quite a holistic package in that it has compensation available for up to $100,000 depending on the survivor's needs, but it also encourages things like providing funding to learn language, because a lot of stolen generation survivors did not have that opportunity. So there's different aspects in each different scheme in the states and territories, but there is still scope for improvement.
Beyond financial compensation, what does meaningful redress actually look like?
So it includes both individual compensation for the harm suffered. It can, in some states and territories, include things like a contribution towards funeral payments. Also, I like schemes that have the personal acknowledgement given to specific individuals rather than apology to stolen generation survivors in general. Some schemes allow for personal apologies, which I think is very significant, but also things like funding to learn language, funding for reconnection, so travelling to country to meet family members and undertaking cultural healing activities. So it can be quite extensive.
We know that the landmark, the Bringing Them Home report, called for these reparations decades ago. What slowed the implementation?
Yes, it did. So Bringing Them Home report was published in 1997, so we'll be having an anniversary of that next year. And it made 54 recommendations, including parliamentary apologies, but also apologies by institutions such as churches and police services. And a report last year from the Healing Foundation had a look at those 54 recommendations and interrogated whether they had been fully implemented. And it was startling finding that only 6% of those recommendations had been fully implemented.
That was Narelle Bedford, Ewan Moorman and Bond University Law Professor, speaking to 4ZZZ's Mary-Kate Hannigan. Coles is facing a major court battle, accused by the consumer watchdog of misleading shoppers with so-called down-down discounts. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission alleges the supermarket temporarily raised prices on hundreds of products before promoting them as price drops, a claim Coles denies. So what does the law say about discounting prices like this, and what could be at stake?
Well, it's quite a subtle and unique question for the court, which is it misleading to present a price as discounted that was, where the discount is only from a price that's been available for a short time before the discount. So the case is essentially about a price that's been stable for a considerable period of time, gone up for a short period of time, then been discounted again. And the court has to decide whether the discount is genuine, even though the price rise was only for a short period of time, or whether the court looks more contextually and says, well, the discount is not a discount on the long-standing price, but only the recent price, and really we should suggest that that isn't a discount. That sounds very, very complicated, but to put it in simple terms, do we look at the literal description of the discount, or do we look at the more conceptual, contextual description of the discount, relying on basically consumers thinking that the price is reduced on what it was before, when perhaps that's not the case if you take that wider perspective?
I guess, could you say the discount is still misleading if the price has dropped from that previous year?
Well, that's exactly the case. So one of the examples is dog food. There was a dog food product that was $4, and it was $4 for over 180 days. And then the price of the dog food went up to $6, and it was up at $6 for, I think, about a week. And then it was discounted to $4.50, and a down-down sticker was placed on the dog food. Now, the question for the court is whether that conduct was misleading. If you take a very literal approach, the dog food had been $6 and now was $4.50, so there was a discount. If you take a broader approach, which is that consumers might not have understood that there had been a very short term price fluctuation before that discount was applied, and that when they bought dog food 2 weeks ago, it was actually lower than the price being offered with the discount sticker. If they take that broader, more contextual approach, the conduct is misleading. There's no law that tells you which one the court should take. The court has to make a decision about that. So it is a very difficult case. And the ACCC is bringing lots of evidence of this pattern of behaviour. And the reason it's bringing lots of evidence of this pattern of behaviour is to convince the court that this is not a one-off exercise, but it is indeed a pattern of behaviour, and incline, I think, the court to say, you know what, it's been done so many times, it's such a pattern of behaviour that it is indeed misleading.
Well, if Coles argues the price increases reflected genuinely on the cost of living or the cost pressures, how might that affect the case, or would it affect the case?
That's actually the reason for the price increase is not actually relevant. I believe Coles will argue that the cost of the products had gone up because of supply chains issues and global disruptions and so on. But the question of why the price was increased actually isn't the question. The question is whether the conduct was misleading. Now, I suppose Coles might present consumers understand that there are global supply chain issues and that prices might go up. Coles never told the consumers that, so it's kind of not the question. The question is really if prices are raised for only a short time before the discount's applied, is the discount misleading, or is the discount literally true and that's enough?
What does a case like this mean for other supermarkets?
Well, I have to say Woolworths is the one who will be most interested in the outcome, because Woolworths has a similar claim against it by the ACCC that it kept prices stable for a period of time, raised them for a very short period of time, and then offered a discount. So Woolworths were watching the Coles case very closely. We don't know if other supermarkets or retailers have been engaging in this practice of what the ACCC is calling illusory price discounts, but certainly there's been at least two previous cases brought by the ACCC of this sort of behaviour. So how widespread it is across the retail market, we don't know. We just don't know at this point of time, but I'd suggest that all retailers will be watching the case closely. It will tell them something about the court's approach to how strictly the court applies the concept of what is misleading.
I spoke with Professor Janine Patterson from the University of Melbourne for more. That was Professor Janine Patterson from the University of Melbourne speaking to The Wire. This week, many Muslim Australians started celebrating Ramadan, the holiest month of the Islamic calendar. It's observed as a month of fasting, reflection, and community. In Australia, 3.2% of the population practice Islam as a religion, and events across the country are prepared to celebrate. How is the community reflecting Ramadan this year, particularly young Muslim Australians? The Wire's Dia Prajnandari spoke with Imam Riaz Sidat, Head of Faith and Community at the Islamic College of Brisbane, for more.
Muslims observe fasting from before sunrise up to sunset every day for a full month. Ramadan is a month of reflection. It is a month of connecting oneself with God and to be able to realign a person's purpose in life and their focus on humanity and trying to understand and be sympathetic and to mankind.
So what is Ramadan like, particularly for the young Muslim Australians?
For young Muslim Australians, Ramadan is a special month wherein the young Muslim Australians have that opportunity to connect with families, connect with the Muslim community by coming close together to the mosques and pray together and break fast together and have iftar meals together. We're out of the month of Ramadan because of people's work schedules and things like that. It becomes very difficult to do. And more important, that it's the young Australian Muslims' ability to strengthen their spirituality as well, to express their religion as well in different ways and forms and with ease as well.
So as Ramadan is celebrated in many countries, is there any difference between celebrating it in Australia and another area, do you think?
So when it comes to the practice of fasting and the rituals that take place around Ramadan, there's no difference whether it be here or anywhere else. It's just that in Ramadan itself, the key difference might be is you have maybe certain cultural cultural rituals that they would normally do in Ramadan, which most of the time does not affect religion. So they would do it maybe in India or Indonesia or something, whereas here in Australia it's a bit more diverse because of the diversity of Muslims around.
So what are your reflections of Ramadan this year after what happened in Bondi?
Look, firstly, we obviously do not, we feel that what happened in Bondi was a tragic loss, and we obviously do not like what had happened, and we wish that there was peace in the world. But more than that, I think from a Muslim's perspective, I think we want to see an end to all fighting in the world. We want Ramadan to be a month where we can have peace with one another, peace with our neighbors, peace with our friends, peace with the wider community. Ramadan is actually a month where we as Muslims look forward to having a month of peace. One of the teachings of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is that in the month of Ramadan, if somebody comes and argues with you or fights with you, you just walk away, you show restraint, and you tell them, look, I'm fasting. I don't have time to have arguments and fights with anyone. And the reason for that is it be able to train ourselves to be able to interact with people in a more peaceful manner. So for Ramadan, what we would want from this, after what happened in Bondi, would be that, you know, if communities can come together, different faith-based communities can come together with peace, with dialogue, instead of highlighting hate and bringing about diversion and division in the community, rather to accept diversity and to be able to bring people together with hope. And that's what we all want for Australia going forward.
And then what do you hope for during this Ramadan for the society?
What we would love for is for people to understand the differences that we have are not major differences. We have more things in common with every person.
That was Imam Riyaz Sidats, Head of Faith and Community at the Islamic College of Brisbane, speaking to the Wise Dia Prajnandari. And that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for your company wherever you are in Australia. The Wire Weekly is a collaboration between community radio stations SYN in Melbourne, 2SER in Sydney, Radio 4EB in Brisbane, and contributors from all across the country, with the great support from the Walkley Foundation and Community Radio Network. We'll see you next time with the stories making headlines across your community and Indigenous radio, at the same time on your local station. Check out all of this week's stories at our website, thewire.org.au. And follow us on social media. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word, on X or on Facebook and Instagram at The Wire Independent Current Affairs on Radio around Australia. The Wire Weekly acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire Weekly is brought to you by SYN in Melbourne, Victoria. I'm Amina Shakur. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time with many more stories on The Wire Weekly.